On the program today, all the happy music in stocks of late. Precious metals beg to differ. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, today, 27 July. Good as always to have you here, everybody. You know, trying to figure out on a day-in, day-out basis why markets are moving one way or the other. Well, that way madness lies, right? But looking big picture, trends, not specifics, that can pay off. And so we bring you today equities, stocks versus precious metals. Stocks, as we know, have been having a grand old time since the lows of March, constantly betting that things are going to get better. I mean, you have seen the record highs, right? Not all record highs, though, are record highs. To wit, gold, famous, of course, as the safest of safe havens, where investors go when they get scared of all the other assets that are out there. And as it starts bumping up against $2,000 an ounce, Marketplace's Scott Tong reminds us rising gold is a sign of falling confidence.
Gold is typically a none-of-the-above investment. When there's no other good answer, people buy gold. Let's first look at bonds. They pay investors interest, or yield, which gold doesn't. But the Federal Reserve has kept interest rates super low, which, if you factor inflation, means bonds may be losing value. Stephen Dunn is investment manager at Aberdeen Standard.
If you're in an environment where you're expecting yields to be low or negative or zero for an extended period of time, which is what the Fed has suggested, it certainly sends you searching in other directions.
Like gold. Well, what about stocks? They've been on a run for months. But analyst Edward Moya at the currency broker Oanda says that's hard to sustain when the pandemic is getting worse.
The virus uncertainty is what's really concerning people. If we don't have any earnings growth, if we don't see these companies really making money, how can this stock market rally continue?
He says investors have growing doubts there. One alternative is the U.S. dollar.
The dollar is no longer king, and it's going to pass that crown over to most likely the euro. Europe handled the virus a lot better. Europe is having a stronger rebound.
When the dollar falls, gold tends to rise. Moya says in the past week, retail investors have joined institutional investors in the precious metal. But as a last resort, gold can be volatile too. Finance professor Campbell Harvey at Duke has tracked the long history of gold prices.
What we found was that gold is an unreliable hedge. So even at the beginning of the COVID-19 crisis, gold fell in value.
For now, though, the rush continues. Gold is closing in on $2,000 for 1 ounce. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced his party's new economic support package late this afternoon. It's called, in that catchy way Congress likes to title its legislation, it's called the HEALS Act. Health, economic assistance, liability protection, and schools. We're a ways yet, of course, from an actual package to go to the White House. Congressional leaders are meeting tonight, but it's going to be a couple of weeks easy. Weeks during which that $600 a week of extra unemployment benefits won't be had. Those payments were critical for workers who'd lost their jobs. We've been covering that for you. But also, as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, critical for some of the small businesses that employed those workers.
When Sophie Blake closed her jewelry store in Virginia at the beginning of the pandemic, she says she had some difficult conversations with her four employees. Two she furloughed. The other two she cut to part-time. When she first heard about the expanded unemployment benefits,
my first initial response was go ahead and take it because this is extra support for you because I don't know when I will be able to rehire you back.
At the time, Blake had applied for a Paycheck Protection Program loan, but wasn't sure whether she'd get one. But she did know that one of her employees should probably stay away from work.
Because she's asthmatic and she is expecting, so for her, the decision was very clear.
That clarity helped businesses make decisions about their own futures early in the pandemic.
Initially, it was a lifesaver.
Mark Fryer owns three restaurants in Vermont and had to lay off about 130 employees when COVID hit. He says the expanded unemployment benefits let him focus on making plans to stay in business while ensuring that his employees would be taken care of in the meantime.
We want them to succeed and we want to help them grow their careers and we hope to continue to employ them well into the future.
Small businesses, whether they're restaurants or jewelry stores, also need to know that their customers can afford to come in and spend money. Nathan Tankis is research director for the Modern Money Network.
That's the whole idea around these kind of programs that are supposed to sustain demand, is that they have all these kind of indirect knock-on positive effects.
The resurgence of infections in parts of the country is having a negative effect on demand. Sophie Blake reopened her jewelry store, but sales have fallen this month. Mark Fryer has brought back about 100 of the employees he laid off, but says he wants that more robust safety net to be there if he has to close again.
That's the elephant in the room constantly with other restaurant owners that I talk to, is that fear that we're going to have to reclose come fall, and then what happens?
Fryer got a PPP loan, but says it'll likely run out soon. Of his three restaurants, the one that's doing the best is the one with the most outdoor seating. But this is Vermont we're talking about, and come fall, it's going to get cold. And he's worried that then he won't be able to make enough money to keep his doors open. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Here's a data point for whatever personal matrix you've got going to figure out when you might be able to go back to the office or, you know, radio studio. Google said today it is keeping the 200,000 or so people who work for it working from home till July of 2021. So there is that to start your week. The week on Wall Street started on an up note because, of course, it did. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There is always going to be a subset of people in this economy who just are not going to wear masks. Health policy guidance, state and local regulations, and corporate policy notwithstanding. So you're a retailer trying to do the right thing, and a would-be customer has a problem with you doing that. What are you supposed to do then, huh? Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has that one.
Walmart, Target, Lowe's, CVS, Home Depot, Costco, they all have policies now that say, if you want to shop here, you got to wear a mask. When an employee confronts a customer who refuses, well, let's go to the video.
I work for Costco, and I'm asking this member to put on a mask because that is our company policy. So either wear the mask.
And I'm not doing it because I woke up in a free country.
This one ends peacefully. The Costco employee takes the guy's card away. But these situations can spin out of control. Joel Bynes is a managing director at Alex Partners.
It's simply too much to ask a frontline retail worker who's already concerned for her health during this crisis and still showing up to work to also intervene in something that could escalate quite rapidly.
So a lot of retailers are reportedly telling their workers to not enforce these mandates. Craig Rowley at Korn Ferry says that's similar to the way stores handle shoplifting. They tell workers to say things like, would you like me to hold those slippers for you at the register?
But if the person runs out the door, most retailers will tell the employee, don't chase the thief. It's not safe for you, and it's not safe for the people around you.
Rowley says even if retailers don't enforce the rules, just having them will get more people to wear masks. It's worked on him. He used to forget to mask up when he went to the supermarket.
Sometimes I'd say, I'm only going in for a loaf of bread. I'll be in and out. I won't cause any problems. But now I don't. Now I'm 100% of the time wearing my mask into the store.
The United Food and Commercial Workers International Union is calling on stores to enforce mask rules with local police or trained security guards. But in Michigan, a man shot and killed a Family Dollar security guard for telling a family member to wear a mask. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
We did a story a couple of months ago about how brands in China are turning to live streaming to sell and thus stay in business during the pandemic. According to the Chinese government, 265 million people watched live stream sales shows last year. A research firm over there figures live stream sales are going to double to almost $140 billion this year. But as Marketplace's Jennifer Pack explains now from Shanghai, for all those companies thinking about jumping on the live stream bandwagon, not so fast.
This time last year, Sam Tian took a big gamble. He quit the ad sales job he'd had for years and convinced his girlfriend, Eva Wang, to leave her teaching gig too. Then they moved from Beijing to the e-commerce hub of Hangzhou. Together, they started a live stream channel on Alibaba's e-commerce app, Taobao, to sell cosmetics. And they tried to have fun, sometimes singing karaoke. Picture a low-budget version of QVC or other home shopping networks, with a lot more viewer interaction. Sam says he expected that within 3 months, they'd earn more than they did at their old jobs.
The talent agency boss told us that this was a realistic goal. He said with our looks and my previous sales experience, we could earn $4,300 a month, so long as we stick with it.
But after live streaming at least 6 hours a day for 100 days straight, they still weren't earning enough sales commission to cover their expenses.
It was a real struggle, and we wondered whether we should give up on live streaming. My girlfriend and I were fighting a lot.
They managed to stay together, but they no longer host a live streaming show. Sam says a lot of it was down to just luck. And local media reports are starting to ask whether live stream sales are overhyped. Chinese state broadcaster CCTV spoke to a sportswear firm in southern Fujian province. It had hired a live streaming influencer who claimed she could sell a lot in one show, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth. But a company spokesperson complained.
In the end, she only sold $13,000 worth. And the next day, she was bragging to others that she had helped us make $200,000 in sales.
Industry insiders say people do sometimes exaggerate their sales figures, but it's not widespread. Ji Shengli is the founder of Jitao, one of the bigger talent agencies in Hangzhou.
I think a lot of retailers claim they were fooled, but they weren't. They just didn't have realistic expectations or any understanding of this industry.
For example, he says refunds are common, as high as 50% return rate for clothing.
Female consumers might buy the same piece in two colors and two sizes to see which one fits better. If they like it, they might keep one and return the other three, or they might want a refund on all four items.
Just 1% of total retail sales in China last year came from live stream e-commerce, according to industry sources. But with the pandemic, even manufacturers now want a piece of live stream sales. People like Zhou Weidong, who walks into the Jitao office without an appointment, bed sheets and pillow samples in hand.
Our sales revenue has dropped by a third since the pandemic hit. So I'm here today to find other sales channels.
As for former live stream host Sam Tian, well, he's still in the industry. But nowadays he works mostly behind the scenes, and so does his girlfriend. They're not certain that live streaming will make them rich. But Sam says he's not giving up on his dreams.
I hope the next time we meet, I'll be really successful.
As successful, he says, as Apple's Steve Jobs. In Hangzhou City, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So I've run 1,000 miles since I've been in quarantine.
Get rid of all that wasted commuting time, add some pandemic stress, boom, there you have it. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 114 points today, 0.4%, 26,584. The NASDAQ up 173 points, that's 1.6%, 10,536. The S&P 500 up 23, 7/10. Finished at 32.39. Pharmaceutical company Moderna saw its shares up 9% today in response to the news that its potential vaccine is entering the third stage of testing starting today. The company is going to begin testing around 30,000 volunteers to see if it's effective. Two other major pharma companies didn't see as much of a bump today. GlaxoSmithKline up 0.2%. Eli Lilly banked 0.6%. Bonds down, yield on the 10-year treasury up to 0.61%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. This was China's first box office weekend since the pandemic started. Doolittle was apparently big over there. Also, the thriller Bloodshot. A bit less than half of the theaters in China are open. Limited, to be sure, to 30% capacity. But hey, it's people in seats, right? Good news for hard-hit Hollywood. But premiering a film overseas and not here at home does come with some risks, as Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports.
As of last week, over 40% of China's movie theaters are open at less than half capacity. The result, according to Chinese data, a $4.7 million three-day debut for Doolittle and $2.6 million for Bloodshot. That's pennies compared to what Hollywood blockbusters usually rake in. But Sky Canavis with China Film Insider says,
it's really right now one of the few avenues that Hollywood has available for its films.
The thing is, Bloodshot and Doolittle had already premiered months ago in the U.S. and around the world. A bigger question Hollywood is facing right now is how to release a brand new film. Do you go straight to streaming, like Universal did with Trolls World Tour, and risk the fury of U.S. theaters? Do you postpone indefinitely, like Disney recently did with the much-awaited Mulan, and disappoint fans? Or a third alternative might be premiering films in theaters in countries that have already reopened. That's the strategy for Warner Brothers' highly anticipated new sci-fi movie, Tenet, which will open internationally in late August ahead of its Labor Day release in the U.S.
It'll open the right doors. Some of the wrong ones, too.
It might also open the doors to rampant digital piracy, which already costs the U.S. at least $29 billion a year. Professor Mike Smith is with Carnegie Mellon University.
As soon as you release it in some of these markets, you're going to get a pirate copy that originates from the theatrical screening. And that pirate copy is going to infect the worldwide markets.
A lot of questions for Hollywood and fans, and for now, not a lot of answers. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Back when this whole thing started, the early days of this pandemic, some scientists were able to start trying to figure out the virus and how to stop it. Most scientists, though, had to stop actual research in their actual labs. Marketplace's Erica Barris talked to some of them a couple of months ago about having to stop their work and what it would take to get it all going again. She got some of those scientists back on the phone the other day.
When we last heard from Isabella Rauch, she was preparing to reopen her immunology lab at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland. A couple of months earlier, she had shut it down, tossing out cell samples and euthanizing mice. Now her lab is open again, but she can only fit 50% as many scientists into it. So?
We do about 50% of the amount of research.
The new normal? Masks, video calls, and extensive cleaning of equipment, such as a microscope that costs more than $100,000.
Of course, you can't just, spray Lysol over the thing, but we have these very special cleaning agents for each part of the microscope.
And that takes 15 minutes before and after anybody uses it. Meanwhile, rebreeding mice for experiments isn't going as smoothly as planned.
Some of the mice decided they're not interested in it right now.
At Washington State University's medical school, labs are also open again in limited capacity. Dean of Research John Roll says the amount of research has been diminished, not just by social distancing, but because
researchers are buying PPE with their research funds.
That's money that would otherwise have gone towards.
It may have gone to conference travel, perhaps research assistant salaries, subject compensation, equipment.
Research has also restarted for Kevin Sheth. He's a neurologist at Yale who does clinical trials on traumatic brain disorders. One of his studies involves 120 research sites across the country. About half of those are up and running again, but they look different than they did before.
Electronic consent, doing virtual follow-up, making remote assessments, shipping study drug to patients directly.
And all of that costs money. So the question is, what happens when the original research grant runs out? I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Uh-huh. One of the enduring and seemingly so far unanswerable questions of this summer is what to do about schools, K through 12, colleges and universities. They are all trying to balance health against online education. Derek Lindstrom is in the thick of that. He's the dean of the School of Liberal Arts and Cultures at Minneapolis College. He is also one of the 10 people we have been following in our series about the American labor force called The United States of Work. His wife, Christina, by the way, we should say here, works in education as well. Derek, it's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, nice to talk to you.
So we were checking our files. It has been since March since we had you on, which frankly seems like forever ago. First of all, how's life in quarantine for you?
It's been eventful, actually. In May, Christina's dad passed away. And so we had gone from quarantine to quarantine and hospice, you know, the whole cycle of healthcare during a pandemic. So
it wasn't COVID, was it?
It wasn't COVID. In fact, I don't want to say COVID was a blessing, but one of the positive things that came out of this was, you know, our goal was to keep him in the house as long as possible. And we were all home, we were able to do that. So we were really fortunate to be able to spend that time with him.
Yeah, small blessings. Okay, so otherwise, I mean, you do have a day job, which you and so many millions of the rest of us have been doing remotely. The catch, of course, is that you are in education. You're running a school. How goes it? And, oh, by the way, school starts probably really soon, too.
Yeah, so we are in the last week of our summer session, and fall session starts in 4 weeks. And so it's been a steep learning curve, but things are going pretty well. We converted 96% of our courses in the summer to fully online. And so haven't really spent any time on campus really other than, you know, grabbing stuff from the office. But some of the things we did is we invested in training for faculty over the summer.
Well, that's good. What is your sense of what enrollment's going to be like for the fall? Do you know yet?
We don't. I'm cautiously optimistic. Typically, a third of our enrollment comes in the last 4 weeks to begin with. We're down. Mm-hmm. Our peer institutions in the metro area are down equally as far. And so I think that there's just a overall hesitation of anyone to make any commitments until they know for sure what's going to happen.
How do you... So this is a little squishy of a question, but I'm going to throw it out there. We'll see how it goes. How do you decide, right? And by decide, I mean like everything. How do you decide what to do professionally with the students nominally in your care? How do you decide to do whatever you're going to do with the people working for you? How do you decide with your kids and with your in-laws who are still with you? I mean, how do you calculate all that stuff?
Oh, yeah, that's a really squishy question. You know, I'm always trying to think about the safety of our students, faculty, staff. Kids are tricky. You know, we get mixed messages all the time about what's safe, what's not safe, because we as a country can't make a decision in what direction we want to move unilaterally. Every decision is an individual decision that each family member needs to make.
When we talked in March, you had started running in the mornings to sort of work out some of your, I guess, frustrations and anxieties and stuff. You still running?
Yeah. I met my 2020 goal, which was 1,200 miles on Saturday.
Wow.
So I've run 1,000 miles since I've been in quarantine.
Wow.
With no commute to work, I have more time to put in some extra miles.
I hear you on that one. I hear you. Derek Lindstrom, we got him up in the Twin Cities. Derek, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you, Guy. Have a good day.
You too. This final note on the way out today, just to frame the looming debate over the economic support package that, in theory, Congress will be debating. Here is some of what's in the Senate GOP's bill. Another round of $1,200 direct payments to people, but probably with a lower income threshold to be eligible than last time. Another round of the Paycheck Protection Program, liability protection for businesses, and some kind of unemployment support, probably, although these are reports only, probably limited to about 70% of wages. It'll come to $1 trillion in all. Remember, the House passed its $3 trillion plan back in May. All right, we are out of here. Here is your moment of economic context, though. The Fed meets tomorrow and Wednesday. The thing to look for, IMHO, is the number of times that Jay Powell and the gang used the phrase fiscal policymakers, which is, of course, Congress and the president and economic support. All right, we're going. Our daily production team includes Bridget Botner, Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.